From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. These are stressful times for those in North Carolina's mental health system. According to a variety of reports, private providers are struggling to treat the state's 360,000 mental health patients. A psychiatrist shortage is making things worse for those who live in rural areas. Budget cuts are taking their toll. And new Medicaid changes, which roll out today, are only going to add to the confusion. Is the system in as bad shape as it might seem? And what is North Carolina's responsibility to provide ongoing mental health care to patients? Kathy Reiter knows the mental health care system very well. Her son Thomas was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, autism, and a number of other mental health problems. He's been hospitalized 14 times in the last 9 years. She struggled to get Thomas the care he needs and is now the plaintiff in a lawsuit suing the state for equal access to mental health care services. And Kathy Reiter joins us now on the phone from Henderson County. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
We're welcoming your calls as well and emails. You can call us at 877-962-9862 or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. What is the state's responsibility to care for those with mental health problems? And what are some of the solutions to the challenges this system faces? 877-962-9862. Kathy Reiter, tell us about Tom and who's caring for him right now.
Thomas has a one-on-one, yesterday it was called a CBS worker. Today it's called community support. And that person basically helps him function in all of the different places that he goes, in school and at Boy Scouts and in the community, and helps him figure out how to stay out of trouble, on task, and be appropriate. So that person permits Thomas to stay at home with me versus being in an institution.
And he is at home with you because you adopted him out of foster care at the age of 3, is that right?
I did, and I had absolutely no idea how hard it would be to get the mental health services that he needs and how hard it would be and what it would cost for me to keep him at home. But that's what I want to do.
Well, and you already knew by then that he did have problems, because those problems were caused by some of his very early experiences.
Yes, unfortunately. And I think one of the things that people don't understand, and the state hasn't done anything to clarify this, is that mental illness can be managed. It can't be cured. So Thomas will be bipolar the rest of his life. He has attachment issues. He's got control issues. He has anger issues. Those things can be managed, but there is no magic cure and there's no magic parenting strategy that will fix it and make it go away. And the current state plan doesn't recognize that he'll need lifetime worth of help.
What kind of services did you get when you adopted him and for those first few years?
Well, the social workers told me if I loved him enough that Thomas would be fine. So I, in my naivete, believed them. And then it didn't take long to start thinking, but I do love him. Why isn't he getting better? What more do I need? Didn't have much in the way of therapy, and finally found a psychiatrist who said, this is complicated, and it isn't your parenting that's the problem.
And are you? And now, do you have help parenting? Are you a single parent?
I was widowed 2 years ago. I've got 3 adopted children. All 3 have mental health issues, and all 3 are struggling real hard and working real hard on being able to stay home with me.
And you say you got a psychiatrist to look in on this problem. Did you have to pay for that? Did the state offer any support?
The psychiatrist does take Medicaid, and there are very few who do, and there are a limited number of Medicaid slots for psychiatrists to accept it, because Medicaid doesn't pay that well. And I was just lucky enough to find someone who, we snuck in under the Medicaid allotment in his practice.
So the psychiatrist tells you, oh, this is complicated, you're going to need some help, you're going to need some therapy and more treatment.
Right.
Then you went back to the state and said, I'm going to need some help with this, and what happened then?
Very little. Thomas was not getting appropriate therapy. We had a case manager that changed. It seemed like every month there was a new case manager of the month. They were trying to do talk therapy, which a kid with his kind of issues can't sit across from you at the table and talk about why he explodes. You need to kind of go at it through the back door. You need to have some particular skills in ferreting out the information. So we were going from therapist to therapist and case manager to case manager, and he was falling apart. I live in Henderson County, finally found a therapist in Greensboro, and was driving those 3 hours once a week, sometimes twice a week, in an effort to help him, you know, manage his anger. And eventually he had to be put in a residential placement for 6 months that I had to pay for out of pocket because the system wasn't working for him.
Why did you have to drive to Greensboro?
I couldn't find anybody in the Hendersonville-Asheville area who knew the kinds of complex mental health issues that Thomas had.
You eventually sued the state under an equal access clause, mm-hmm. saying that you should have equal access to mental health services. Tell us about that. What do you mean by equal access?
Well, Medicaid is a federal entitlement program for kids who are either in the foster system, those who have been adopted, or kids who, from a financial point of view, qualify for Medicaid. And it's an entitlement program, and there's a list of services that that describe everything that a child should have for physical and mental health. And then there's a caveat that says anything else that's prescribed by a physician. My physician, my psychiatrist, in tandem with Thomas's family practitioner, agreed he needed a particular kind of therapy. He needed some respite opportunities to catch his breath, and he also needed crisis intervention. I finally found an attorney, Lewis Pitts, through the legal aid services there in Raleigh, who was able to help me file a suit to say to the state, yes, this child is entitled to this. We need you to help us get it.
Eventually, you won that suit, and the state agreed to provide these services,
right.
But that hasn't solved the problem. Tell us about that.
I'm still waiting. And if you look at the documents and the court records, you know, the system all the way up to Carmen Hooker Odom said, yes, this child is entitled to this, and they tried to argue that Thomas had all of those services, when in fact the information that they sent to me very clearly said Thomas doesn't have the IQ and is too aggressive to be able to use the programs that they argue are out there to solve his.
So that has become part of the problem, that at three years old, when you adopted Thomas, you could at least make the effort to love a child who may be aggressive and difficult.
Right.
He's now 6 feet tall. He's over 200 pounds, and there are times when he has to be restrained.
Yes.
And this requires a different kind of care, but the facilities that you'd like to get him to won't take him for that very reason. Is that right?
Because he is too aggressive, and his IQ is low. He's got some developmental delays, and that's just it. It's not a good fit. There are three programs that they offered in the Asheville-Hendersonville area, and he didn't meet the admission criteria for any of them. And the psychiatrist is arguing that he needs crisis intervention other than a hospital and other than jail. And right now, that's what the state is offering.
But it's not available to you because that's where you live. Because it's not available in the place where you live,
mm-hmm.
Have you pursued federal as well as state financial services? Is there any other money available at the federal level?
Well, not that I'm aware of. Medicaid is a federal and a state combined program, and then there's some small adoption assistance that comes from the state level, none of which covers the out-of-pocket expenses for his therapy and intervention.
We're talking about North Carolina's mental health system today on the state of things, some changes in the system and how it works and how patients will have to make choices among the private providers in the state's mental health system. You can give us a call at 877-962-9862 if you've had experience with the state's mental health system. Also, if you have had trouble accessing the system, 877-962-9862. I'm talking with Kathy Ryder, who has adopted a boy, Thomas, at the age of 3 years old, who is now suing to get services that should be provided by the state under state law. Where are you now in the legal struggle, Kathy?
We filed another court document saying that the state admitted responsibility for providing these services and hasn't done it. And I heard, coincidentally, they tell me, from a provider in the safety net program here in Mountain Laurel, which is in Henderson County, who came out to my house and said, well, we can give you all of these things that you want. I'll be back in contact with you. That was 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, and I'm still waiting. So right now, I'm still waiting.
You've been dealing with this for how long? Something like 14, 15
yep.
years now.
Yep.
How have things changed in terms of the availability of services? I mean, even if you had access, how have they changed in terms of availability? How much is out there?
Well, it used to be that you went through the mental health agency and they helped you match up with a case manager and a therapist. Now the providers are working independently, but the problem is people don't want to work for the system, providers don't, because they're not being reimbursed. They have to carry the state, as it were, financially and wait 30, you know, 60, 90, 120 days to be reimbursed for the cost of caring for my kid. So it's not easy to find somebody who's willing to work with the state as an individual provider.
Do you get any sense that there are private providers out there that if money wasn't the issue, if you didn't have to go through the state, that there's enough service out there for those who could afford it?
Yes, I do, definitely. Yes, if you didn't have to depend on Medicaid or Health Choice, there are providers who are qualified and interested available even in our little rural part of the state.
Kathy Ryder, I would like you to stay with us. You're caring for your son, Thomas, who suffers from a variety of mental health problems, suing the state for equal access to mental health care for her son. We're talking today on The State of Things about North Carolina's mental health care system and what responsibility the state has to those with mental health needs. Kathy Ryder is with us, and we're taking your phone calls and emails at 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Just ahead, we'll talk more about some of the challenges facing the mental health care system in North Carolina. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and we're talking today about North Carolina's mental health care system and whether or not it is doing enough for mental health care patients in the state. Joining us now are Phoebe Zerwick, a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal. She was one of the reporters who worked on a series for the journal that looked at how the state's 2001 mental health reform plan was working. Phoebe, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Sure. Dr. Marvin Swartz is with us as well. He's the head of the Division of Social and Community Psychiatry at Duke University School of Medicine. Marvin Swartz, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we're taking your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862. Emails SOT@WUNC.org. What is the state's responsibility in mental health care? Have you had any experience with the mental health care system in the state of North Carolina? 877-962-9862. Phoebe, let me start with you. A lot of the confusion in the system stems from the deinstitutionalization or privatization system that began in 2001. Tell us a little bit about that transition.
Well, I mean, it came as a result of a number of factors, but for decades there's been an effort to deinstitutionalize people, which means to let them out of the state mental hospitals and find services for people in the community. And in 1999, the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to keep people in state institutions when they could be served in the community. There were also, around that period of time, there were some problems with some local mental health agencies that had been set up years ago to provide mental health services for people with mental illness. And so in 2001, the legislature decided to handle all these problems with a kind of sweeping reform effort. And what they did was mandate that these local agencies, which some were single county agencies and some were regional agencies for several counties, that instead of providing services, in other words, instead of having staff psychiatrists, staff social workers, staff therapists to provide services to people, they would become more like managed care companies or insurance companies. They would contract with private agencies and then refer patients to those private agencies and be in charge of funneling state money that's available to pay for care for people with mental illness, and also in charge of helping to funnel Medicaid money to those private agencies. And the theory was that the market would create conditions where private companies would spring up to provide care for people that had previously been cared for by the state.
And that didn't happen, and in large part that was because the dollars really weren't there to provide that care.
Exactly. It gets very, very complicated and confusing, but part of the money was supposed to come from reducing the size of the state mental hospitals. Well, you can't reduce the state mental hospitals until you've got services, and you can't pay for the services until you have money to pay for the services. And another chunk of money was supposed to come from these new Medicaid rates that take effect today, 3 years after the reform began.
Marvin Schwartz, I'm surprised. I was surprised when I read this, the series in the Winston-Salem Journal about this. This is a process that's been going on for decades, deinstitutionalization, and the problems that seem to crop up here in North Carolina had been well documented for decades, the fact that the money didn't follow the patient. What happened here, and was the state not able to learn the lessons of earlier efforts at deinstitutionalization that began, frankly, in the early 60s?
Well, I think they had learned the lessons and had studied what other states had been doing and engaged consultants who, you know, knew the story pretty well. And so I think the process of fact-finding was more than adequate. I think part of the problem had to do with the unexpected shortfalls in the funding that was expected to support the transition. The legislature was to appropriate a significant amount of money for bridge funding to get from here to there in terms of growing community capacity. We expected to be able to reduce the state hospital bed allocation, which hasn't happened. But I think if there's any surprise in the plan, it was that the scope and the massive scope of the plan was not feasible, that there was too many parts to change. I've likened it to trying to change a transmission on a moving car. And we just were not in a position to try to affect all the pieces of mental health reform and get the funding in place at the same time.
And at this point, that still is the case. It still really isn't quite fixed.
No, we have a significant shortfall in the funds needed to adequately create the community capacity that would allow you to reduce the state hospital allocation. The state hospital beds are entirely supported by state money. To the extent that you can reduce the state dollars that are wholly going into the state hospitals, you can reinvest it in Medicaid services that are federal and state. So for every dollar you pull out of a state hospital, in effect, you get $3 of community care. That's the strategy, and the strategy hasn't been realized yet.
And the main problem is the care hasn't developed. Those private agencies, those private providers haven't been here because, as far as they're concerned, there's not the money to pay for it.
Well, I think one of the other surprises was that we really didn't have the infrastructure of nonprofits and for-profit provider groups out there in metropolitan and rural areas who were willing and able to ramp up their services to provide and take on the range and complexity of these services.
So, Phoebe Zerwick, in your study, and this was done a couple of years ago, what actually happens to those people who aren't getting, who have fallen between the cracks?
Well, just to correct something, our stories ran back in December, so just a few months ago. And it's very hard, you know, we had a lot of anecdotal evidence that people weren't getting the care they needed, and there was some factual evidence in the fact that admissions to the state hospital from Forsyth County have nearly tripled in the past 4 years with the advent of reform. But the local mental health agency here doesn't keep very good data on what's happening to people. So we had, as I said, anecdotal evidence that there were patients who weren't getting the care they needed. And what seems to be happening is that they're ending up back in the state mental hospital instead of getting treatment in their homes.
And this means that the dollars that are supposed to be leaving the state hospital can't leave because those beds are being filled. And in fact, there's even a greater demand for now care in the mental hospitals. Is that right, Dr. Schwartz?
That's right. The North Carolina Psychiatric Association several months ago issued a report in which they noted that the state hospital bed utilization has actually gone up in two areas, in adult admissions and in child admissions. So kids with children with psychiatric disorders have increased their rates of admission. So in those two areas, we've seen increased utilization of state hospital beds.
And this all comes at a time when overall spending on health care, when adjusted for inflation, based on some research you've done, Dr. Schwartz, is down more than 11% over the past, say, 10, well, at least between 1988 and 1998.
Right. Part of the issue here is that over the last decade, private insurers have been allowed to reduce their funding for mental health so that in the last decade, approximately There's been a reduction of maybe 6 to 7% of the health dollar going to mental health and substance abuse disorders, and now we're down to about 3 cents on the dollar. Most experts think we should spend about 10 cents on the dollar. When you have that kind of shrinkage in the services that private insurance offers, the burden then falls on the public sector, and it's estimated that that lack of parity in insurance benefits is costing the state about $100 million a year.
And tell us a little bit about the changes that go into effect today. What's changing, and what do people who are now receiving mental health services have to cope with under these new provisions?
Well, the changes are quite good. The services that were identified are the types of community-based services that we really do need to keep people living and able to function in the community. These were the sorts of services that are really the replacement services for hospital beds. Some people refer to some of these services as hospitals without walls. So it's the availability of mental health professionals to go into the home or go into the workplace or go wherever it's needed to try to help folks do well in the community and receive rehabilitation services.
But they have had little time to make these decisions. This is in some ways like the Medicare, the Part B program that went through, when you're having to make choices now about providers, where you're going to get your services. And it seems to me that folks have had about a week or two to figure out where they're going to get their services now.
Well, the implementation of the new services has required a lot of rapid changes on the providers' parts, on the state parts, on Medicaid parts, and it has been very difficult on consumers to try to understand the system, to try to navigate, and to try to understand the services that they'll be getting.
Phoebe Zerwick, what kind of, when you did documented the fallout and the state's follow-up on its reform that began in 2001. One of the interesting things was a state auditor's report back in 2000 that said, look, the state's mental hospitals are beyond repair. They, at the very least, that whole system has to change. Has there been much change in the state's mental hospitals? Have they changed or improved since that report was issued?
Well, I don't know that much about that topic, but the state is going to replace Dorothea Dix Hospital, which is the old hospital in Raleigh, with a new hospital in Butner, and so they've broken ground on that hospital. But I can't really speak very knowledgeably to that.
What about that, Dr. Swartz? How much change has this reform meant to the state's hospital system?
Well, the auditor's report did call on reducing the number of hospitals from 4 to 3 in the central region, creating one hospital, because all four of the hospitals had significant architectural problems, and there wasn't a hospital that was really up to code for modern psychiatric or hospital treatment. So we have embarked on the new central hospital campus, and that's coming along. However, the significant financial cost, and the state has been strained to find the resources to build that hospital, let alone the upfitting that's going to be required at the two other hospitals, Cherry and Broughton.
So do you have any sense at all of how many people or what percentage of those who have needs in mental health care are not being served now in the state of North Carolina?
I can't tell you for the state of North Carolina. I can tell you that nationally, about one-third of people with significant mental health problems get treatment. Two-thirds do not. And I don't have a direct estimate for North Carolina.
Is this a problem strictly of money? There's simply not enough money to pay for it all, or is it organization as well?
Well, we have a problem in terms of how we provide services and also the distribution of services. The how-to is that many of the folks that deliver mental health services deliver the care that they learn to give when they're in school. And it takes a continuous investment in your workforce to bring them up to new standards, to teach them new types of services, new ways of delivering care. That type of investment in the workforce is badly needed in North Carolina so that all providers have provided the best evidence-based treatment that we can offer. The other issue in terms of organization is that we still have a terrible problem with maldistribution. We don't have professionals well distributed across the state. We have a clustering in metropolitan areas.
Phoebe Zerwick, the part of the theory behind privatization back in 2001 was that it would create some competition and some better services. That hasn't happened. Were you able to determine why?
Well, a big part of the problem was lack of reimbursement for the services that these private companies were expected to provide. And hopefully these new Medicaid rates new Medicaid services will help correct some of that. But a lot of the reimbursement is still low for private providers to really make a go of it. One thing that when all these services were provided by the county, the agencies were large enough that what they would do is they would, use their state subsidy to subsidize the services that weren't so profitable for the people who needed care. And the fear is that private agencies aren't going to want to take on the patients who are the most expensive to care for.
Well, Dr. Schwartz, theoretically that shouldn't happen. If what's changing here is the state going from provider to manager, mm-hmm. the money should still be there, and they should be able to provide money for a private provider, theoretically, if you're in the Henderson area where somebody like Kathy Reiner lives.
But as Phoebe quite rightly points out, there were a lot of cross subsidies that were affected when the agency, the local community agency, was a public sector entity. Monies were used to cross subsidize services. Now every service has to pay for itself, and when you have that kind of organization, there are services that are going to be losers, and that agency may feel it can't provide those services.
I'm going to bring Kathy Reiter back into the discussion. We talked with Kathy earlier in the program about her son Thomas and her difficulties in getting the state to provide services. As you look at the changes now in the Medicaid system, do they offer new opportunities for you and better ways, at least at the very least, more money to provide services for Thomas?
No, actually, if you look real carefully at the service definitions, what they're doing is they're giving you several short-term solutions. They're calling it community services, and it's a time-limited service. And when you look and your child, like mine, won't get better in a particular period of time, they will then ratchet it up to what they call intensive in-home services with parenting skills, which in itself probably isn't bad, but that's not the reason Thomas isn't doing well. So if in the short term the community services doesn't work, the intensive in-home doesn't work, it doesn't take long before the only option left is residential, which is costly. So in reality, I'm in a worse spot now than I was yesterday with Thomas staying at home.
Dr. Marvin Schwartz, as you look at this, it seems that accountability is an important question, particularly when you spread the services out now. The state is the manager. The private care providers are giving the service. What are the accountability checks in here, and do they seem sufficient in this program?
Well, the part of the reform was motivated because of a lack of accountability. The auditor's report found that because of the organization of the old mental health system, there was no clear point of accountability. Now the state plan does call on the local management entities, the LMEs, to be accountable for the quality of services that are provided. And there is a quality improvement effort, and there's a reporting system and an appeal system. So the LMEs, at least in theory, are the point of accountability in this system. Whether they're operating well, I don't know. We have enough experience to tell.
One of the interesting points you make in your report is that you are, in fact, in a sense, a vendor. You're somebody who could provide these private services on the one hand, and that makes you an advocate for mental health care. You're a psychiatrist. So in some ways, as you point out in your report, the privatization has in some ways neutralized the effect of an advocate because you're also a vendor. There's a kind of an appearance of conflict of interest at that point.
Yes, that's happened in mental health reform. It's happened in other states where as advocacy groups flex up to provide services, their role as advocates gets blurred with their role as vendor or provider of services, and that's a conflict. And you know, it raises the question of whether something I might say you're going to take on the face of it or feel that I have another motive in mind.
Kathy Ryder, as you have listened to this program and some of the things that have been said by Phoebe Zerwick and Marvin Schwartz, how much of it has resonated with you?
The scary thing to me, Frank, is that we're not getting an honest addressing of the issue at the legislative level. They're rationing health care, and they're arguing that it's due to budget cuts, when in reality it's decisions that they're making. And that families like me need to be able to call and say to the people who represent us in Raleigh, if you don't put money into mental health, then you'll put it into jails and you'll put it into hospitals, and the people won't get better. So you need to put your money up front and help keep the young people at home and doing well in a cost-effective manner out of jail and out of the emergency rooms. And that's what's happening. They just don't want to admit that they're rationing health care. They're saying something else.
We are talking about the state of mental health care in the state of North Carolina. How much should we spend? How much do we spend if we don't tackle the problem head on? Kathy Ryder is with us. We're going to say goodbye to Phoebe Zerwick from the Winston-Salem Journal. Phoebe, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Marvin Schwartz will stay with us, a psychiatrist at Duke University School of Medicine. Just ahead, more of your calls. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about the mental health care system in North Carolina. Budget cuts and other challenges have left the system in crisis, according to some reports, so we're taking a look at the problems and potential solutions today with Dr. Marvin Schwartz, head of the Division of Social and Community Psychiatry at Duke University School of Medicine. Kathy Ryder is with us. She is a mother and has been working to get services, mental health services, for her son Thomas, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Dr. Schwartz, you heard what Kathy Ryder said just before the break. If we don't pay for mental health services of the kind that are helpful, then children will end up probably in the criminal justice system to the tune of $30,000 a year in the state's penal system.
I think that's quite right, and you see that phenomenon going on across the spectrum. We've reduced funding for mental health both in the private sector but also in the public sector. North Carolina now, according to a recent report by the North Carolina Psychiatric Association and validated by the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors Research Institute, says that North Carolina is one of the lowest states in state funding for mental health services, roughly 43 out of 50 states. And so we have not funded services adequately, and we haven't had the kind of legislative advocacy that we need to keep our mental health services on par with the other kinds of health services we provide.
It's a big bill if you look at it. Any idea what it might cost? I mean, if you were to put together the budget that in your mind would adequately take care of the problem, how much money are we talking about?
Well, one piece is to change insurance law so that private insurers can no longer cost shift mental health to the public sector. That would not cost very much. The estimate from the Congressional Budget Office is that it would cost no more than 1%, probably less than 1% of insurance premiums would solve that problem and reduce the burden on North Carolina of about $100 million. So that would be one solution. In terms of new funding, North Carolina Psychiatric Association estimated somewhere on the order of $280 million were needed to get North Carolina to the mean for this state's per capita income.
Well, on the line with us now is North Carolina State Representative Verla Insko. Representative Insko is part of the legislative body that did implement the transition to local management of North Carolina's mental health care services. Verla Insko, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When this idea was on the table, what was the idea behind privatization?
It was to bring more accountability into the system. The system as it was the area programs had a dedicated source of revenue, although it wasn't enough money, and they received the patients, they evaluated them, they provided them services, and then they had an internal assessment of whether those services were adequate. So part of it was to separate the management of the system from the service delivery, so the managers of the system who are managers of public dollars and are the stewards of public dollars, then could oversee the quality of the service.
Has that happened?
I think the LMEs are still struggling to learn that role. It's a very different role. The other factor was that there were private providers in the state who wanted to participate in the system, and because of various funding factors, it made a lot of sense for area programs to keep the patients or the consumers for themselves so that they could generate more money. So there was also that factor. But I think that the role of the LME is very different under this model, and that we have not done an adequate job of providing enough training for that transition for people to learn this new role.
But even if they did, is there enough money in the system?
Oh, no. And there wasn't enough money in the system before. And there's still not enough money in the system. And as a matter of fact, some money has been cut from the system. And so I think that the infusion of new money this year is critical now that we have the new service definitions around. And you all may have talked about this before, but one of the big gaps is that many people are eligible for services. They're part of our target population, but they aren't Medicaid eligible. Anyone between the age of 19 and 64 who doesn't make any difference how poor they are, if they don't have children, dependent children, they're not eligible for services. So those people used to get worked into the system under the old area programs, but under the new service, the way the services are delivered now, they really are without funding. And so we need to provide state funds to pay for those services. And that's, to me, that's the big need right now.
Is there any research that's been done on what it really does cost the state not to provide these services in terms of emergency room visits, in terms of the legal system intervention and, cost of the prison system, if that's where people end up?
Well, it is where they end up. And we have looked at pieces of that. We know what a bed costs in a prison system. We know the general percentage of people in the prison system who have mental health or substance abuse problems. And we have looked at pockets of emergency room services. It's hard to tease out those things so that they're isolated and alone. But it's a very significant cost.
Kathy Ryder, you chose to adopt a young man who you knew had some mental problems. He was 3 years old. You're now struggling to make payments. He would have been left in the foster care system had you not chosen to adopt this child and make him your own. And according to the state, after that, your problem, not the state's anymore. Have you ever regretted that decision?
When I go to balance my checkbook, sometimes I wonder about the decision that I made, but I love him passionately, and it's the best thing and the hardest thing that I've ever done. And he wouldn't have been in foster care. He would have been in an institution. He would have been in a mental hospital somewhere, locked up insecure with the keys thrown away because he was that disturbed and continues to be that aggressive. And it's just a matter of hard work on his part and hard work on my part that he's still at home.
Verla,
it's the most cost-effective place for him to be.
Verla Insko, as you hear a story like that, does it put in stark relief to you the choices that a state makes? We can choose to keep this Kathy's problem and maybe thank our lucky stars it's not ours, or does the state really have a responsibility to say, I may not have had that child born into my family, but I do have to bear some of the responsibility? Is that the question that voters face and you as lawmakers face?
Well, we do have a responsibility, both economically, as you discussed before, that when these consumers don't get the services they need, they actually become more expensive to the state. But just also from the moral point of view, that this is these are human lives who have the capacity to contribute to society if they receive the right kind of services and to have a full life. And so just morally, we have a responsibility to do it.
Dr. Swartz, you got at this a little bit earlier, but I want to talk in more detail about the funding that's available, not much money available for overhead so that a private provider gets paid for the service, but the state really doesn't want to pay for overhead. And that's where you say some of the research is done. So if we want to develop new treatments, that's what gets hurt under this formula.
Well, the great achievement of the community mental health services over the last 40 years has been one-stop shopping. so that a patient could go to one place. If he or she had complex needs, that one place would take care of them. What we've done is not only fragmented that system, but we fragmented some of the overhead and the cross allocations that would be available. The other thing that's happened is it makes it very hard to train these small mom-and-pop shops, that we have these small organizations out there. And if we used to have a public sector workforce that we cared for and fed because it was our workforce, it's not clear whose workforce it is and who's going to make the investment in that human capital. That's the most valuable resource we have, are the people delivering the services, and we really need an adequate plan to continually train them.
I do want to go to the phones. We promised to take some calls. Michael is on the line from Wilmington. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Frank.
You have a
Can
question?
You hear me?
Yep. You have a question for us?
Well, I have a question and also a comment. I've got a meeting with my state senator, and with the head of the state mental health on Wednesday and my local mental health director, because two-thirds of the people that were getting mental health services didn't have Medicaid, and I don't believe they had any insurance. I'm wondering who's going to serve these people, particularly after the legislature took the $30 million it had allocated for this and spent it somewhere else. And I'm also curious about Dr. Swartz, a report he wrote, I think, with his counterpart at UNC a few years ago. He had a number of recommendations. I'm wondering where we are on those recommendations.
All right. Thank you, Michael. First, those underserved. You talked about that, Verla Insko, a little bit, those people who have been dropped from the rolls, in effect. What's going to happen to them?
Well, we have to have people across the state, and I'm glad to hear from a caller in Wilmington, because we need support from all across the state so that consumers will let their representatives know that we need this money this year in the short session to come in. And we're talking with the governor's office and with the department to make sure that the governor and the department and the General Assembly have a figure that's manageable, and but will also help address the need. And I think this year is very critical.
Dr. Swartz, some recommendations at this point, and those recommendations that you have made, maybe you can tick off one or two and give us your assessment of how things are going.
Well, I think, Representative Insko has said, we really need to get the attention of the legislature in terms of adequately funding this system. They gave the secretary a job to do, which was to reform the mental health system. They need to now back that up and provide the funding they need. One of the recommendations that we made that I think has been really critical is that we noted during the auditor's report that the central office had been starved, so that the brains to run the system, to transform the system, needed to be we needed more funding in the central office so that they could run the system and make plans and make reform work. Since reform, they've actually lost positions, so that we now spend less on the central office, on planning and running the system, than just about any other state. We're at 11% of other states in terms of central office functioning. And you can't run a system. You can't affect change. Now, no one wants to advocate for bureaucrats, but I think so it's not a popular or sexy thing to do. So when we have budget shortfalls, we protect services and cut out the administration. But we are so threadbare in terms of administration and the ability to evaluate what we do that we don't have many answers.
Well, Verla Insko, Representative Insko, let me ask you that, because you heard what Marvin Swartz said. I think it's a sentiment that's pretty widely held. No one wants to support bureaucrats. It's probably what was behind the accountability problems that led to deinstitutionalization and privatization a few years ago. Is that the problem now that you see what happens when services become disparate and there's not enough money to provide, particularly in rural areas? Should we begin to look at better ways to hold public servants accountable rather than push this off on the private sector and not have enough money to encourage that sector to provide service?
Well, I would just comment on Dr. Swartz's comment that the central office doesn't have adequate help there, and I agree with that. And not only do they not have enough people, but I think that the division is in the same position that the LME directors were, and that is that their role has changed. The division's role has changed from one of sort of being a policeman of the area programs to make sure they were following the rules
in order to provide leadership to help the LMEs understand what reform was. And I would say that the General Assembly is in that same position, that we are learning a new role. How do we provide appropriate oversight of the division and the area programs so that the transformation actually does take place? And I think we've all three of those groups have fallen short.
Well, can the state begin to reconsider and consider whether or not you can provide service and adequate oversight and accountability out of the same package and use that critical mass of funding that public funding provides?
Well, yes, I think that you can have accountability. You can have a firewall between management and service, and have both sectors be public. We have one example of that in Rockingham County, and there are three counties. One is a service. One has provided services. The other two counties are providing LME services for their constituents. So there's not any reason why we can't have public sector providers. And in addition, the secretary has always had the authority to waive this provision of privatizing. That's part of the law, was that the LMEs are responsible for adequate delivery of services. So no LME should have divested before they had an adequate network of providers available. And that was just a great, misstep early on, that LMEs divested too soon.
Why do you think it's so difficult to get state money, to get money to fund mental health services in North Carolina?
I think it's partly we focus on education and economic development. I think so those other things take a lot of the money first. I think we have not had adequate consumer involvement and advocacy. The DD disability group is the best funded, and that is the best organized advocate group, and their providers are also well organized. So I hope as we have more providers come into the system and that consumers get better organized to be advocates, that they will work with their legislators and that we'll have a raised consciousness, if you will, about this need.
Well, Dr. Swartz, also this happens against a backdrop of a real shortage of psychiatrists in the state of North Carolina.
That's right. The Shep's report that was recently released argued that there were 44 counties in North Carolina with a shortage of general psychiatrists and two-thirds of counties with no child psychiatrists. So another piece we need to look at and come up with a plan to address is the shortage of psychiatrists and how we can get them better distributed and also assure that we have a supply in the future. Because as North Carolina grows, we're not keeping up with the pace of growth in this state.
There you go, Representative Insko. Another item on your agenda.
Well, and I'd like to just comment that as I've listened to the conversation, even what I've said, that we have several LMEs that are delivering superb services, and they're doing a great job. This is not all doom and gloom. And we do have models of excellence, and I think that we are moving forward, and we have more best practice treatments being delivered in the state now than we have ever had before.
All right, State Representative Verla Insko, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Marvin Swartz, head of the Division of Social and Community Psychiatry at Duke University School of Medicine, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things today. If you want to hear an archived edition of a past program, you can go to the website at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.